closing. Moses attempted to persuade the committee members to endorse at least some of his proposals, but LaGuardia, working through Windels, the committee's chairman, made sure they didn't, by employing relentless pressure. Windels would decline, years later, to furnish any details of the infighting. "But I'll tell you this," he said. "When it came to things like that, LaGuardia was as hard and as shrewd as they come. Whatever it was necessary to do, he did." The committee declined to recommend a single one of Moses' proposed sites or any diminution whatever in the powers of the LaGuardia-appointed and dominated City Housing Authority. LaGuardia handled all negotiations with Federal Housing Authority Chairman Nathan Strauss personally. He made all announcements of new projects from his own office and in general made sure that Moses never knew what new public housing project was being planned until the planning was completed and the necessary federal funds allocated. Moses raged, publicly assailing the secret, surreptitious program, but he could not budge the mayor. By the end of 1941, 13 separate public housing projects containing a total of more than 17,000 apartments had been constructed in New York, far more than in any other city in America, and Moses had had nothing to do with any of them. The mayor was even able to indulge himself in an additional soupçon of personal satisfaction. The printing bill of the four-color brochure Moses had distributed at the Museum of Natural History was more than $1,000. When Moses submitted the bill to Comptroller McGoldrick, the mayor smilingly told the comptroller, "A beautiful printing job," and ordered him not to pay it. The tunnel and housing fights convinced LaGuardia, according to Windels, Kern, Burrell, and other top mayoral assistants, that his park commissioner was intent on increasing his personal power. And LaGuardia, determined to concentrate power in the city in his own hands, acted as he would have acted toward any rival. The unifying motive behind Moses' actions in both fights was his desire to expand his power. In the tunnel fight, to attain power to build not just bridges, but all interborough crossings. In the housing fight, to extend his power, hitherto limited to the fields of parks and transportation, into a wholly new field of governmental endeavor. LaGuardia kept Moses' power confined within its traditional spheres. Following the tunnel and housing fights, moreover, the mayor began to re-examine the implications of the virtually unlimited power he had given Moses within those traditional spheres, and to conclude that his power should be curbed in those spheres too. This was not, according to the mayor's top aides, a wholly new feeling. For some time, they say, he had been becoming worried about aspects of Moses' park policy, the same aspects in general that were worrying reformers like Exton and Weinberg. If he had not discerned before precisely what those policies meant for those of the city's people who most needed parks, he was beginning to discern it now. Windels recalls the mayor raging when he realized that the prices Moses' concessionaires were charging at such new city-built or refurbished park restaurants as the Tavern on the Green and the Claremont Inn were so high that they could not be used regularly by poor or even middle-class families. In transportation, LaGuardia had had a vague feeling ever since the beginning of his mayoralty that great road-building projects must be accompanied by corresponding improvements in mass transportation, but because he admired Moses' parkways and bridges, he had not pressed the commissioner to include provision for mass transportation on them. But as new parkways and bridges became jammed as quickly as they opened, the vague feelings hardened. By 1939, LaGuardia would be pressing Moses hard indeed as to why he was not paying more attention to the suggestions of the Regional Plan Association. And beyond questions of parks and transportation, the mayor had for some time been becoming progressively more aware of the question that a later generation would call priorities. By 1938, he was acutely aware that the great strides made in parks and parkways were not being matched in any other areas of public works, not even in areas like schools and hospitals, in which the need was desperate. His feelings about Moses had subtly and gradually but substantially changed by the time I resigned as corporation counsel in 1937. Wendell says. He still felt he had matchless abilities and energies, but he also felt now that those abilities and energies must be channeled in the right direction if the city was to benefit from them. Now, with the mayor's feelings intensified by the tunnel and housing fights, he was worried about how much power Moses had in the city. Kern says, I know because he kept talking about it. He felt Moses' power must be reduced. These feelings really became very strong. And this analysis of the mayor's feelings was documented by the mayor's actions. In November 1938, shortly after Moses' museum speech, he cut from the list of WPA projects at least two large park projects he had earlier promised Moses he would include. In December, LaGuardia stood up to him, and to the New York Times, with a new firmness in cutting the park department's budget request. Early in 1939, the mayor made it clear to Newbold Morris and Joseph McGoldrick, his Board of Estimate allies, that they were to take a harder line on Moses' requests to the board. But by 1939, the mayor's feelings were not to be nearly as crucial to Moses as they had been in the past. To a large extent, in fact, he no longer had to concern himself with such feelings. To a large extent, it no longer mattered to him what the mayor thought. Of all the remarkable qualities of Robert Moses' matchless mind, one of the most striking was its ability to take an institution with little or no power and, seemingly, with little or no potential for more power. At Yale, an unprestigious literary magazine, in state government, the Long Island State Park Commission, and to transform it into an institution with immense power, power insulated from, and hence on a par with, the power of the forces that had originally created it. And now, the mind of Robert Moses had begun focusing on the institution known as the public authority. Chapter 28. The Warp on the Loom. No state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. The Constitution of the United States of America, Article 1, Section 10. The authority shall have power to make contracts. Consolidated Laws of the State of New York, Chapter 43A, Article 3, Title 3, Triborough Bridge Authority. The public authority was not a new device. The first of these entities that resembled private corporations but were given powers hitherto reserved for governments, powers to construct public improvements and, in order to pay off the bonds they sold to finance the construction, to charge the public for use of the improvements, had been created in England during the reign of Queen Elizabeth. By the time Robert Moses went to Oxford 300 years later, there were 1,800 such part public, part private bodies in England, including the huge Port of London Authority, named Authority because the clauses in the Act of Parliament that spelled out its powers began with the words, Authority is hereby given, and highway building boards whose roads were named turnpikes because they were blocked with horizontal bars, or pikes, set into revolving pillars that would be turned aside to let a carriage pass only after the toll was paid. But the public authority concept was new in the United States. There may, or may not, there exists no reliable history of authorities, have been a few collecting tolls on rural roads. Hearing rumors of one in North Carolina, Jimmy Walker contemplated setting one up in New York to enrich his friends. But at the time Moses went to Oxford, the only urban authorities in existence on the western side of the Atlantic were a bare handful set up to build small water supply systems. The Port of New York Authority, the first large authority in America, modeled on its London counterpart and created by an interstate compact between New York and New Jersey, would not be created until 1921, would not float its first bond issue until 1926, and would not become financially successful until 1931, when, after 5 years of near fiscal disaster, it would persuade the two states to let it take over the highly successful Holland Tunnel, which had been constructed by an independent commission. It was not until the New Deal, when depression-strapped municipalities, unable to finance major public works themselves, suddenly realized that RFC and PWA grants were available for self-liquidating projects, that urban authorities began to be established in any number. In 1933 and 1934, when Moses was playing the crucial role in setting up the Triborough, Bethpage, Jones Beach, Henry Hudson, Marine Parkway, and Hayden Planetarium authorities, and a lesser but still key role in the creation of seven other authorities, there were only a few handfuls of other authorities in the entire country. With the lone exception of the Port Authority, moreover, every public authority created in the United States had been created in a single pattern. Each had been established to construct and operate one and only one public improvement, a single isolated bridge or tunnel or sewer system, to issue only enough bonds to pay for the construction of that improvement, and only bonds with a fixed expiration date, and, when that date arrived, or sooner, if revenue was collected faster than expected, to pay off the bonds, eliminate all tolls or fees, turn the improvement over to the city, and go out of existence. The Port Authority, empowered to operate several improvements, had become America's first multi-purpose public authority. But each of its projects fit the traditional pattern, since each was financed by a separate bond issue, and both authority members and public officials expected that as soon as each issue was paid off, the tolls on the facility financed by that issue would be eliminated. Motivated by the failure of several Port Authority projects to earn enough to meet the interest and amortization payments on their bonds, the authority's brilliant general counsel, Julius Henry Cohen, was attempting in 1934 to break new ground by devising a new kind of bond and persuading bankers who held the authority's outstanding bonds to accept the new ones in their place. Under the plan Cohen had in mind, the individual bond issues would be combined into a single general issue supported by the revenues from all Port Authority enterprises, a move which would allow use of the Holland Tunnel surpluses to bail out such money losers as its two bridges connecting Staten Island with New Jersey. And since the new issue would be open-ended, the authority could use any overall surplus to finance new projects. The bankers refused to consider open-end bonds for unspecified new projects, but in 1935 did agree to a consolidation of outstanding bonds in a general and refunding bond that could be used for one new project, the proposed Lincoln Tunnel. And it was this bond, rather than any devised by Moses, that was the first bond issue in the United States secured not by a single public improvement, but by an authority's general revenues. But Moses went much further. Originally, he had conceived of his authorities in the traditional mold. The legislation he had drafted establishing the Triborough, Henry Hudson, and Marine Parkway bodies, for example, had explicitly authorized each to construct only a single specific project and to issue bonds only for that project. The bonds were to be paid off as soon as possible, and not only was a time limit, 40 years, set on their expiration, but that time limit also limited the authority's life. As soon as its bonds were paid off, it was to go out of existence and turn over its bridge to the city government. The legislators who had created Robert Moses' authorities, and the mayor, who under the state constitution had had to ask the legislators to create them, had conceived of them as mere creatures of the sovereign city. Legislators and mayor, as well as the city's citizens, continually reminded by the press of the long tradition that all its bridges be toll-free, had been assured that the tolls would be removed forever as soon as their cost had been paid for. And there had been no deliberate attempt to mislead them. Robert Moses had thought of public authorities as men had always thought of public authorities. But Robert Moses' thinking was changing. The primary factor behind the change was money. The carrying charges, interest and amortization on the $5,100,000 in bonds that had been sold to pay for the Henry Hudson Bridge were about $370,000 per year, a sum that could be collected, at 10 cents per car, from 3,700,000 cars. But the number of drivers handing their dimes to the bridge toll collectors was not 3,700,000. In 1938, it was 10,300,000. In 1939, $12,700,000. And maintenance costs on bridges were, Moses was learning, gratifyingly minimal. Painting the entire Henry Hudson, for example, cost only $18,000, and painting was needed only once in 4 years. The salaries of toll collectors, the only operating personnel required, totaled less than $50,000 per year. "Our bridge was fabulously successful," Jack Madigan would say. "We were earning, after the carrying charges, $600,000 per year net." And that was just one bridge. The Triborough, on which the annual carrying charges were about $1,800,000, but on which the toll was 25 cents for cars and more for trucks, was by 1938 earning per year, net, $1,300,000. More significantly still, on all Moses bridges, the traffic volume for each month was higher than the volume for the corresponding month the previous year. Clearly, volume and revenue was going to be far higher than even those fabulous figures. Under the laws creating the authorities, the bills that Robert Moses himself had drafted on his yellow legal notepads, unexpectedly high revenues could be used in only one way: to retire an authority's bonds faster than scheduled, to speed the date when the authority would go out of existence and turn its bridge back to the city. With surpluses of such unprecedented size, the bonds of Moses' authorities would be retired very fast indeed. At the rate the Henry Hudson Bridge was making money, for example, its cost would be amortized not in 40 years, but in 10 years, perhaps, or 9, or 8. In a decade or less, the bridge that the city had never been able to finance would have been built by Robert Moses, built and paid for, to stand for centuries as a great free public improvement for its citizens. Using the surpluses in the way required by law would therefore make the Henry Hudson Bridge and the Triborough spectacular successes, all the more spectacular in a city in which public works always seem to cost the public more, not less, than anticipated. But this was not the kind of success in which Moses, obsessed by accomplishment and power, was interested. Money, revenue, surpluses, was the key to accomplishment and power, but only if he could keep it and use it. It was of no use to him if he had to give it to bankers as fast as he got it. It was of no use to him if, as soon as he had paid off the bankers, he had to surrender control of his bridges. Money was of use to him only if, in other words, he was able to use the bridge surpluses for other purposes than bond paying, and if he was able to keep control of the bridges instead of turning them over to the city. And under the law, this was impossible. But what if the law was changed? What if, in some way, he was able to keep the money? Madigan and others close to Robert Moses saw his supple mind coiling around the possibilities. The actuality of the money, he began to realize, was not its most significant aspect. Its potential was what mattered. The total annual income of his authorities was, by 1938, $4,500,000. This amount was not insignificant to him. It was as large as his total annual park department budget. But it was not as significant as $81 million. And $81 million was the amount of 40-year, 4% revenue bonds that could be floated. Capitalized was the word in the banker's vocabulary that Moses was learning, with an income of $4,500,000. If he was able to keep the authority's revenues and use them to float bonds, he would be able to float $81 million, or $35 million more than the total $46 million in bonds that the three New York City bridge authorities currently had outstanding. He would have $81 million to use to create dreams and power. Much more than $81 million, in fact. The multiplier factor would be increased by the proven success of his bridges. When he and Jack Madigan had originally been attempting to persuade bankers to invest in the authorities, the ability of toll bridges to attract substantial amounts of traffic had been in doubt, and the bankers had therefore demanded a coverage of 1.75 or 2.00, anticipated earnings double that required to cover interest and amortization, and a return of 4% on their investment. Now, toll bridges were a proven commodity. Bankers might settle for a coverage of 1.5 or even 1.4 and an investment return of 3% or even 2.75. And any reduction in coverage or interest rates meant an increase in the amount of bonds that the authority income could capitalize. More important, if some of the money raised by the floating of new bonds was used to build new bridges on which tolls could be charged, the authority's income would be more than $4,500,000. Since each dollar of tolls could capitalize roughly $18 in bonds, there was therefore an additional built-in multiplier factor at work. The more public works he built, the more money he would have to build still more public works. And this factor would work indefinitely. Forever, possibly. Robert Moses had built public works on a scale unmatched by any other individual in the history of America. But all the highways and parks and bridges he had built were little more than nothing next to the highways and parks and bridges that Robert Moses wanted to build. He had turned into reality his dream of a great parkway along Manhattan's shoreline, but there was still the Brooklyn shoreline and the Staten Island. He wanted parkways there, too, a circumferential or belt for Brooklyn, a shore for Staten Island. And he had wanted them and been arguing for their creation for more than 10 years. He had built 50 miles of highways in the city, but there were 100 more miles that he wanted to build. He had reshaped to his own vision an urban park system that absolutely dwarfed any other urban park system in the United States. But the parks he had created in New York were in their turn dwarfed by the parks that he dreamed of creating. It had been 1930 when he had proposed a Soundview Park and a Flushing Meadows Park and 2 marine parks and a park, the greatest of all urban waterfront parks, in Jamaica Bay. And now it was 1938, and these parks were still only proposals. Where was the Rockaway improvement? Even those parks that he had been able to create in the city, moreover, had not been created as he wanted. He had been forced to scale them down, to use inferior materials, to compromise. As for bridges, he had built in the city 3, including one that was the greatest traffic-moving machine in the history of civilization, but he wanted to build at least 4 more, including one even larger than Triborough. And that was just in the city. What about the areas around it? There were parkways on Long Island, all right, but not his greatest parkway, the ocean and bay-bordered Fire Island masterpiece. There were parks, 11,000 acres of parks, the greatest state park system in the country, on Long Island. But he could foresee all too clearly the day there would be so many people living in the metropolitan area that 11,000 acres would not be nearly enough. After a decade and a half of building public works, the public works he had not yet built loomed before him larger than ever. Moreover, the chances of building them seemed to be growing steadily more remote. Only the New Deal had enabled him to make even as much of a start as he had on his plans for New York City. Now, in 1938, the New Deal well was running dry, and LaGuardia was insisting with a new firmness that he stop trying to lap up the city's share all by himself. Albany was drying up, too. Each year, Herbert Lehman was finding it more difficult to obey the law that required him to balance the state's budget. As for the city, LaGuardia may have pulled it back from the door of fiscal death, but not even LaGuardia could restore it to fiscal health. The corruption that had preceded him had weakened the body politic far too seriously. Political realities, moreover, made it unlikely that health could ever be restored. Existing taxes could support an annual budget, the budget out of which the debt service for new bonds for new public works would have to be paid, of about $575 million, and the debt service and salaries loaded on by Tammany ate up $500 million of that, even before other necessary expenses were figured in. As for the so-called capital budget, there was no leeway in that either. The city was constantly bumping up against the state-imposed ceiling that limited its borrowing capacity to 10% of the total assessed valuation of real property. The city's fiscal inability to construct public works was so pronounced that by 1940, LaGuardia, who had dreamed of carving out a beautiful new metropolis, would have no choice but to limit new capital spending for the year to a symbolic $1. Because the city was a creature of the state, city taxes could be increased and the city budget ceiling raised only by the state legislature, and not only the legislature's conservatism, but the influence wielded within it by the city's own propertied interests, which wanted the key property taxes kept down and, to protect the bonds they held, as few new bonds as possible issued, made the legislature as reluctant to take those steps as LaGuardia was to ask it to do so. Desperately anxious to reshape his city, LaGuardia might be, but he was not anxious enough to court political disaster by asking for new taxes. Surveying such realities, Moses could see no reasonable possibility, in any foreseeable future, of the city being able to finance his dreams. If he wanted to remake the city, it was clear he was going to have to do the job without its money. But if he was able to keep the authorities' revenues, keep them indefinitely, he would have the money. He would, moreover, have money he would be free to use as he chose. Tens of millions of dollars had been placed in his hands already, of course, by governors and legislatures, by mayor and board of estimate, by federal alphabet agency administrators. But these had been millions hedged about by all the safeguards, the rules and regulations and established procedures, the technicalities that had been established by generations of legislators and bureaucrats that made it so difficult to get things done. Tens of millions of dollars had been given him to hire men, but he had been required to hire them according to civil service regulations, which made it difficult for him, in most cases made it impossible for him, to hire the kind of men he wanted, the best men, the best engineers, the best administrators, the best ramrods, the best laborers. Under those regulations, he couldn't pay them enough to attract them to his service. He couldn't even hire whom he wanted of the men available at the salaries he could pay. He had to hire off civil service lists. These regulations could sometimes be circumvented, of course. No one circumvented them as cleverly as he, as was proven by the quality of his Moses men, but they could be circumvented only with difficulty and delay, the delay he hated. And they could not be circumvented wholesale. The Moses men were a prize cadre, but a cadre was not an army, and he was constantly raging at the quality of the main body of his troops, non-commissioned officers as well as enlisted men. Once the Depression eased, civil service salary limits had made it impossible to keep loyal to his colors more than a handful of the prized 750 ramrods he had recruited during its depth. Civil service regulations made it impossible for him even to drive men as he wished to drive them. To drive men mercilessly, you have to have threats to hold over their heads. The ultimate threat, dismissal, was all but denied him by the regulations. And dismissal for even a legitimate cause was a cumbersome and tedious procedure that had none of the efficacious effect on other workers of a snappy, pick up your time and get out from Art Howland or Earl Andrews. Civil service regulations had prevented him from using his men flexibly and efficiently, because he had to hire men out of allocations for a specific upstate or Long Island Park Commission or the New York City Park Department, and civil service regulations required him to use an employee of a public agency only on that agency's work, it was illegal for him to assign an upstater to a city job, even if he was best qualified for it. Most important, civil service regulations required him to hire men only for specific purposes approved by legislature or board of estimate, and these purposes had never included the one most vital to his aims, long-range planning. For more than 10 years, he had been scheming, scraping, and saving to build up a stable planning force, without success. But changing the law would give him one. The legislature had placed public authorities under civil service, of course, But the power of civil service commissions to enforce their edicts rested, as Moses had learned from the bitter experience of his youth, on the power to disapprove salary payments, on the commission's control of the purses out of which municipal and state agencies drew their personal service funds. It rested on the power of money. Let him have the money. Let him keep control of the authority's revenues, and he, this man who had mastered the intricacies of civil service as well as any man who ever lived, would be able to devise 100 ways to manipulate civil service commission rulings to his own ends. He would be able to attract to his service the men his sharp eyes had picked out of the herd, to hire and fire them as he pleased, to provide them with material rewards huge enough to make them endure his driving and his demands, and to guarantee their absolute loyalty. And he would be able to hire men not only for specific, but for general purposes. He would be able to have, at last, his stable planning force. Let him keep control of the authority's revenues, and he would be able to study transportation needs before elected local officials studied them. He would be able to determine by his own criteria which transportation facilities should be built and in which order. He would be able to determine by his own criteria how these facilities should be built, what their design, size, and precise location should be. He would be able to translate these general plans into detailed blueprints and specifications. And then, when the time was right, when a large new state or federal grant became available, or when the public was demanding a solution to the transportation problem, he could present these plans to elected officials as the solution. A solution already engineered, already designed, already costed out. A solution feasible engineeringly and economically. A solution whose planning was already a fait accompli. A solution that awaited only their approval for implementation. A solution for which, in many cases, money, the money of his public authorities, was already available. What official would then be willing to risk public antagonism by withholding that approval? And if an official did dare to suggest an alternative, what good would it do him? The city possessed neither an engineering corps capable of planning large-scale public works, nor money to hire in sufficient numbers engineers who did possess such capability. For that matter, the city had no money to build an alternate large-scale public work if it wanted to. It would be dependent upon the federal government or upon Moses' authorities to provide the cash. Federal money might well be lost by the delay additional studies would entail. As for the authorities' money, cross the man who was offering it, and he might, bearing in mind that the man was Robert Moses, he probably would, withdraw the offer, and the official then could be accused of having cost the city a great public improvement. Let Moses keep control of the authorities' revenues, and there would be no more nonsense about the mayor or the board of estimates studying alternate routes for a highway or alternate locations for a bridgehead, or alternate methods, mass transportation instead of highways, for example, of solving transportation problems. In the fields he had chosen for his own, the city would have to build public works where and how he chose. Additional tens of millions of dollars had been given to him for non-salary items, construction costs mainly, but he had been allowed little leeway in the spending of that money either. Much of it he had had to give to contractors, under strict regulations which not only required him to award contracts to the lowest qualified bidders, thereby preventing him from making awards to firms he personally favored, but also set many conditions designed for economy, a saving of taxpayers' money, rather than for the speed he wanted. Strict restrictions on overtime had been especially irritating to this supreme ramrod, this archetypal top sergeant, who wanted his projects driven forward around the clock. Allocations directly to his agencies allowed him even less leeway. Such appropriations were made line by line for specific items, and members of the legislature or board of estimate, accountable to the voters, and therefore anxious not to make any appropriations that appeared to waste their money, and anxious as well not to let Moses further expand his empire, resisted especially making any appropriations to him for the PR items which would seem blatantly wasteful to taxpayers, but which Moses knew were vital to getting things done. The printing of impressive, persuasive brochures and pamphlets, the creation of large-scale dioramas and scale models. It never ceases to amaze me how you can talk and talk and talk to some guy about something you've got in mind, and he isn't very impressed, and then you bring in a beautiful picture of it, or better yet, a scale model with the bridge all in white and the water nice and blue, see? And you can see his eyes light up, Jack Madigan says. The hiring of public relations men to visit publishers, editors, reporters, and radio commentators, as well as non-media influentials, sell them on a project in advance, escort them on pre-opening limousine or yacht tours, leak them information that would place Moses' views in a favorable light and his opponent's views in an unfavorable light. The rental of the necessary limousines, the hiring of the bloodhounds to dig up facts about an opponent that could induce him to cease his opposition, or, should he prove stubborn, could be leaked into print to discredit him, and, especially important to Moses because it gave him a chance to exercise his matchless charm as host, the laying on of hospitality, intimate luncheons for key individuals, or lavish buffet luncheons for influentials by the hundreds, at which he could drape a big arm over a recalcitrant borough president's shoulders and use the glow induced by good food and fine wine to win him to his cause. He had, of course, used his ingenuity and his skill at circumvention of the spirit, if not the letter of the law, to publish brochures, hire public relations men, purchase limousines, and host luncheons in the past, but he had never had enough money to do all this as lavishly and effectively as he wanted. But let him keep the authorities' revenues, and he would have enough. Changing the law might give him more than money. Changing the law might give him power, more power than he had ever attained before. Money itself is power, of course, but the power he was thinking about now was power of far greater dimensions. A public authority, he had learned, possessed not only the powers of a large private corporation, but some of the powers of a sovereign state. The power of eminent domain that permitted the seizure of private property, for example, and the power to establish and enforce rules and regulations for the use of its facilities, that was in reality nothing less than the power to govern its domain by its own laws. The powers of a public authority were vested in the board of that authority. If there was only one member of that board, in fact, as in the case of the Henry Hudson Parkway Authority, Robert Moses, sole member, or in practice, as in the case of the Triborough Authority, whose other members would routinely rubber-stamp Moses' actions, the powers of the authority would be vested in that member, in him, Robert Moses. And there was another dimension to his thinking, too. Keen as always in discerning the potentialities for vast power in humble institutions, he had glimpsed in the institution called public authority a potentiality for power whose implications no one else, no one in City Hall or the Albany State House for certain, and, so far as research can determine, no one anywhere in the United States, had noticed, but that were exciting and frightening and immense. Authorities could issue bonds. A bond was simply a legal agreement between its seller and its buyer. A legal agreement was, by definition, a contract. And under the Constitution of the United States, a contract was sacred. No state, and no creature of a state, such as a city, could impair its obligations. No one, not governor, not mayor, not state legislature, not city board of estimate, could interfere with its provisions. If Robert Moses could write the powers which had been vested in him into the bond contracts of his authorities, make those powers part of the agreements under which investors purchased the bonds, those powers would be his for as long as the authorities should remain in existence and he should control them. If he could keep the authorities in existence indefinitely and could keep his place at their head, he would hold those powers indefinitely, quite conceivably until he died. The powers might be given to him by the legislature and the governor at the request of the mayor and city council, but if he embodied those powers in bonds, neither legislature, governor, mayor, nor city council would ever be able to take them back. Giving public authorities indefinite existence and such vastly expanded powers would not be easy. In proposing to give the institution substantial governmental powers and a lifespan at least of decades, possibly of centuries, in proposing to make it an institution that might endure as long as the Republic endured, Moses was in effect, whether or not he thought in such terms, proposing to create, within a democratic society based on a division of powers among three branches of government, a new fourth branch, a branch that would, moreover, in significant respects, be independent of the other three. The public officials whose approval was necessary would never give it. Those who were thinking men would realize that if they gave it, they would be adding, without sufficient thought and consideration by themselves or by the public, which should have the final say on matters of such significance, a whole new layer to urban government in America. The rest of them, concerned with power and patronage, would realize that to the extent they gave away power, they would be diminishing their own power. The key body whose approval was necessary, the legislature that under the state constitution alone had the power to create new authorities, had been fighting for years to keep Moses from gaining more power, from building his own empire within the state government. The legislature would never approve the bills Moses was drafting if they understood them. So Moses would have to keep them, and all the other officials involved, from understanding. He would have to persuade mayor, city council, legislature, and governor to approve his bills before they realized what was in them. In 1924, he had faced a similar problem, and had solved it successfully, persuading a naive assemblyman to introduce, and hostile Republican legislative leaders to accept, bills that appeared innocuous, but gave the Long Island State Park Commission vast new powers. This time, however, the job would be harder. His aims now were far more ambitious. The powers which he wanted now were far broader than those he had wanted then. And in 1924, he had had the governor on his side. Now he had no one on his side. If a single person in Albany or New York, Democrat, Republican, governor, mayor, assemblyman, councilman, any of the thousand sharp-eyed lawyers who prowled the Capitol and City Hall caught even a glimpse of his true aims and sounded the alarm, he would never be able to accomplish those aims. He had to conceal his purposes from everyone. The safeguards included in all previous New York State legislation on authorities to limit their lifespan were the provisions setting a time limit on their bonds, a date by which each authority must redeem all its bonds, surrender control of all its facilities, and go out of existence. Moses, drafting amendments to the Triborough Bridge Authority Act, knew that the legislature would never agree to the elimination of these safeguards. So he didn't eliminate them. He just made them meaningless. Right at the beginning of the original Triborough Act, in Section 1, in the portion labeled Existence, the Act said explicitly that the Triborough Board and its corporate existence shall continue only for a period of 5 years and thereafter until all its bonds have been paid in full, a provision which, when coupled with a provision setting the maximum life of the bonds at 40 years, was intended to limit the maximum life of the authority to that span. The amended Triborough Act, which Moses was proposing, said the same thing, in the same place, right at its beginning, in Section 1. But it also said something else. Not at its beginning, and not in the portion labeled Existence, but long, legalistic pages later, buried deep within the Act, in a subdivision of Section 9, a subdivision and a section that ostensibly had nothing to do with existence, there was a new sentence. The authority shall have power from time to time to refund any bonds by the issuance of new bonds, whether the bonds to be refunded have or have not matured, and may issue bonds partly to refund bonds then outstanding and partly for any other corporate purpose.
He had figured out a gimmick, says Reuben A. Lazarus, drafter of the original Triborough Act and himself a master of the gimmick. And as Lazarus spoke, a smile broke over his old, wrinkled face, despite his attempts to conceal it, and his voice was filled with admiration, the admiration of a master of a difficult craft for a man who was more than a master. That sentence looked so innocuous, but it changed my whole act completely. With that sentence in there, he had power to issue 40-year bonds, and every 39 years he could call them in and issue new bonds for another 40 years. LaGuardia had thought that authorities would be temporary creations that would build something and then turn it over to the city and go out of existence as soon as it was paid off. But with that gimmick in there, it would never be paid off. Never. The existence of the Triborough Authority shall continue only until all its bonds have been paid in full, the Act said. But, because of Moses' amendments, the authority no longer had to pay its bonds in full. Every time it had enough money to pay them in full, it could instead use the money to issue new bonds in their place. The amendments meant that unless it wanted to, the authority wouldn't ever have to turn its bridges over to the city. It might, if it so desired, be able to keep the bridges and stay in existence as long as the city stayed in existence. The safeguards included in all previous New York State legislation on authorities to limit their scope were the provisions setting a limit on the amount of bonds each could have outstanding, a limit sufficient to pay only for the specific project or projects the legislature wished it to build and nothing more. The Triborough Act contained such a provision, a clause stating that the authority could not have outstanding more than $53 million, an amount sufficient only to cover its $35 million share of the cost of the Triborough Bridge and the $18 million cost of the Bronx-Whitestone Bridge. But Moses' gimmick made that restriction meaningless, too. For by authorizing the authority to issue new bonds not only to pay off old ones, but also for any other corporate purpose, it was authorizing it to keep its indebtedness at $53 million even though it had money available to pay off part or even most of that figure. If, for example, the income was high enough to pay all its carrying charges and also accumulate a surplus, which after 5 or 10 years amounted to $20 million, the authority could then call in $20 million of its outstanding bonds, pay them off, and therefore have only $33 million outstanding. Its legislatively authorized borrowing capacity would still be $53 million. Its revenues would support that amount of bonds. So the authority would have $20 million of borrowing capacity. It could issue $20 million in new bonds and use the proceeds of the sale for any corporate purpose. And what were such purposes? The original Triborough Act had given the authority power to build only the two bridges and their approaches. Moses' success in persuading the PWA that approaches could mean roads leading to the bridges had greatly expanded the authority's power. Now, he proceeded to expand it further. The new, amended Triborough Bridge Authority Act that Moses was proposing still said first that the authority's powers were to build bridges and their approaches. But in later sections, it also said some other things. The Act empowered the authority to acquire land for and construct not only approaches, but new roads, streets, parkways, or avenues connecting with the approaches, and to widen existing roads, streets, parkways, or avenues connecting with those approaches. The word connecting was innocuous, unless one began to think closely about what it would mean if Moses expanded its definition as he had expanded the definition of approaches. If an approach was miles long, the Queen's approach to the Triborough Bridge, for example, was 6 miles long, scores of roads, streets, parkways, or avenues intersected, connected, with it. Under the amended act he was proposing, the Triborough Authority would have the right to widen any or all of them. It would have the right to build a new thoroughfare that would connect with the approaches anywhere along their length. And how long could that thoroughfare be? A block? A mile? 5 miles? 10? Could it be a highway that ran clear across the city? Under the amended act he was proposing, it certainly could. And suppose he wanted to build another, third highway to intersect with the one he had built to intersect with the approaches. Since this new third road would connect with the second, and the second would connect with the approaches, why could not the third be said to connect with the first? Under a liberal definition, a definition such as Moses had long since proven himself adept at making, quite possibly it could. Quite possibly, in fact, one could say that any major thoroughfare in the city connected with any other. And if one could say that, one could say that the act that Moses was so carefully drafting would mean that the tri-borough authority would have the right to construct highways throughout the city, in many respects exactly as if it were the city government itself. And not just highways. Another clause in the act gave the authority power to construct and develop for the purpose of public parks lands acquired in connection with the Whitestone Bridge project and with new or existing roads, streets, parkways, and avenues connecting with such project. Under the act Moses was drafting, the authority would be able to build parks along any highway it might construct. Since the authority would be able to build highways throughout the city, it would be able to build parks throughout the city, too. And not just highways and parks. Buried still deeper within the act Moses was drafting was a clause giving the authority the right to build and operate any facilities for the public not inconsistent with the use of the project. Not with the project, with the use of the project. Since the project consisted of bridges, roads, and parks, why, under that clause, would it be inconsistent for the authority to build housing nearby that would allow more members of the public the convenient use of those bridges, roads, and parks? Why, for that matter, would the construction of any public facility be inconsistent with the use of the project? An aggressive authority chairman, anxious to stretch the powers in the act to the limit, could well find in that phrase legal authorization to build any type of public facility he chose anywhere along the authority's bridges, roads, streets, parkways, avenues, and parks. Anywhere, in fact, in the city. And the best bill drafter in Albany set to work to make sure that, in building and operating its projects, the authority, despite the limitations on its power by the state legislature, would nevertheless possess powers equal to those possessed by the state, or by the city of which, in theory, the authority was merely a creature. Legislature and mayor had sought to ensure that the authority would be subordinate to the city by including in the old act the provision that the city comptroller should be the authority's fiscal agent. The new act included the same provision. In drafting the section entitled Monies of the Authority, Moses began it, in fact, with the flat statement, "All monies of the authority, from whatever source derived, shall be paid to the comptroller as agent of the authority." The meaning of this sentence must have seemed clear to any legislator who read it. The definition of fiscal agent was well established. He was the individual empowered to receive and pay out a corporation's monies. But later in the section, Moses added another sentence. "The monies shall be paid out on check of the comptroller on requisition of the chairman of the authority." With that sentence added, the comptroller, while still authorized to receive the authority's monies, would be able to pay them out only on Moses' requisition. Would, in other words, be able to do with them only what Moses wanted him to do. He was still required to take Moses' money to the bank and deposit it there, but he was now forbidden to take the money out again without Moses' signature on the withdrawal slip. The sentence that Moses had slipped into the act meant that although the comptroller of the city of New York would be called the authority's agent, he would really be no more than its errand boy. Legislature and mayor had sought to ensure that the authority would be subordinate to the city by including in the old act the provision that the city would own all tri-borough projects. The new act said that it did, flatly and clearly. But it also said that the authority shall retain full jurisdiction and control over all its projects. The city might own the Triborough Bridge, but only the Triborough Bridge Authority could run it. By the time Moses had finished drafting his amended acts, his authorities had not only all the powers of bodies corporate, but many of the powers of bodies politic, including bodies politic that were sovereign states. His authorities had the right to do all things that a business corporation can do. To sue, for example, to make contracts and bylaws, to acquire real estate and use it or lease it or dispose of it, and, of course, to issue bonds. And they had the right to do many things that private corporations could not do. They had the power to own public facilities, to require the public to pay tolls for their use, and to prevent the construction of competing facilities so that the public had no choice but to pay those tolls. They had the right to govern their domain by making their own laws, rules and regulations for the protection of their property, which shall have the force and effect of law, with violations triable by a city magistrate and punishable by not more than 30 days' imprisonment or by a fine of not more than $50, or both, and to maintain their own police force, hundreds of authority bridge and tunnel officers, to enforce those laws. They could have their own great seals, and alter the same at pleasure, and set their own statute of limitations. A private citizen suffering damages by negligence of a private corporation had 3 years to sue. A private citizen suffering damages by negligence of the Jones Beach State Park Authority had 6 months to sue. They had the sovereign power of eminent domain, and more. Not only could they take a private citizen's property, they could enter the land before it was taken to make the surveys necessary to decide if they wanted to take it. Never again would some Long Island farmer be able to ram a shotgun against Sidney Shapiro's chest and keep him off his land. They had, in fact, some powers that sovereign states, at least the sovereign state of New York, did not. They could let contracts without competitive bidding. Their officials could be removed only for cause. They were immune from the pleasure of the governor. And Moses made sure that these powers corporate and politic, and in some respects greater than both, would be embodied, ultimately, not in the authorities, but in him personally. In the case of the single-member authorities, of course, the authority was Robert Moses. The Triborough, Jones Beach, and Bethpage authorities had 3-member boards. But while their enabling acts said, "The power of such corporation shall be vested in and exercised by a majority of the members," it also said, "The board may delegate to one or more of its members such powers and duties as it may deem proper." Then Moses set to work to make sure that no one would ever be able to take those powers away. He did it in Section 9, Paragraphs 2 and 4, Clauses A through I. Paragraph 2 authorized the authority to pass resolutions governing the sale of its bonds. The various clauses of Paragraph 4 said, when taken together, that the resolutions could contain provisions dealing with toll rates, authority rules and regulations, and any other matters of like or different character which in any way affect the security or protection of the bonds. And Paragraph 4 also said that any such resolution shall be a part of the contract with the holders of the bonds. Legislation can be amended or repealed. If legislators were in some future year to come to feel that they had been deceived into granting Robert Moses wider powers than they had intended, the right to keep tolls on a bridge even after the bridge was paid for example, they could simply revoke those powers. But a contract cannot be amended or repealed by anyone except the parties to it. Its obligations could not be impaired by anyone, not even the governing legislature of a sovereign state. Section 9, Paragraphs 2 and 4, Clauses A through I, gave Robert Moses the right to embody in Triborough's bonds all the powers he had been given in the legislation creating Triborough. Therefore, from the moment the bonds were sold, thereby putting into effect the contract they represented, the powers he had been given in the legislation could be revoked only by the mutual consent of both Moses and the bondholders. They could not be revoked by the state that had created the authority or by the city whose mere instrumentality it was supposed to be. If he copied into the bond resolutions the legislation giving him the right to charge whatever tolls he wished for as long as he wished, from the moment the bonds were sold, that power could never be revoked without his consent. If he copied into the bond resolutions the legislation giving him his other new, broad powers, those powers could never be revoked. the elected representatives of the state and city might have given Robert Moses those powers, but the elected representatives of the state and city would never be able to take them back. Previously, Robert Moses had always needed what he termed executive support. He had learned during his first great effort in public life, his attempt to reform the municipal civil service, an attempt brought to naught by his betrayal by John Peroy Mitchell, that as long as he was an appointed official,